Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A day after her husband died, Corey Richens bought a mansion. That's not a rumor. That's not a theory. That's a date on a closing document that a forensic accountant carried into a Park City courtroom and laid in front of a jury with 30 years of experience reading exactly this kind of paperwork. March 4th, 2022, Eric Richens dies. March 5th, 2022, Corey Richens closes on a $2.9 million property in Midway, Utah, borrowing $3.2 million to do it, walking away from the table with $87,000 and not a dollar left over for renovations. One day, that's the gap between a husband's death and a real estate closing. Richens has pled not guilty to the murder of her husband. She maintains her innocence, and she's presumed innocent under the law. But prosecutors spend all day in that courtroom doing one thing, showing the jury exactly what the financial picture looked like in the months leading up to March 4th, 2022, and asking them to decide what it means. And I'm going to ask you to decide what it means as well in the comments section, either on YouTube or our Substack. The links are in the description. Is this all innocent? Did it just happen to be that Eric unfortunately died of an overdose right before a critical closing for Corey's business that, you know, it was planned way before any of this happened. It's just signing paperwork. Closing really isn't a whole lot of work. It's already there. You might as well just do it because delaying means changing the paperwork and this. And yes, I get it. I've closed on a lot of properties in my life. And yeah, it's a hiccup. You don't necessarily want to ever have to change that date. But your husband just literally got zipped up into a body bag and hauled out of your house. If there's ever a cause or a reason to maybe take a breath, and I'm not trying. The irony of that statement. I think that might be it. That might be the reason. Especially one that he didn't want you to do, because if you just look at the math, you go, what the hell are you doing, Corey? What in God's name are you doing with this money? What is wrong with you that you seem to think this modality of what you're doing, this, and we're going to get into all the details of her financial, I don't know if chaos is the word, madness, insanity, ineptitude for basic understanding of addition and subtraction. Narcissistic borderline explosion in its purest form. I mean, that's, again, in my opinion, I can't diagnose the woman, but goddamn. your thoughts in the comment section. And please press subscribe wherever you're listening to this. So to do all this, they called in Brooke Carrington. Carrington is a forensic accountant with more than 30 years of experience. She told the jury she reviewed hundreds of thousands of documents in this case, leasing records, loan documents, bank statements, a premarital agreement, real estate transactions. Her job, as she described it, is to understand the financial landscape. And the landscape that she described in court was not a picture of a thriving businesswoman hitting a rough patch. According to Carrington's testimony, it was a controlled demolition that had been underway for at least a year before Eric Richens died. Here's how it started. In 2019, Corey's house flipping company, K. Richens Realty, purchased one home, $215,000. In 2020, five homes totaling over $2.2 million. By 2021, 15 homes totaling over $6.7 million. On paper, that's explosive growth, the kind of trajectory that gets you featured in a local business profile, the kind of numbers that make lenders want to talk to you. But Carrington testified that across all of those properties, Corey's lost over $900,000 in contractor costs, closing fees, deals that didn't perform. The growth was real. The profit wasn't. And by August 2021, the account started telling the total story. Corey wrote $60,000 in checks to herself that bounced. By October 2021, Carrington testified the business account was, and she used this phrase directly, perpetually in the hole. In December of 21 alone, there were 77 overdraft or non-sufficient fund transactions. That's not a bad month. That's a system failing in real time. Those 77 transactions cost her $200 or $2,000 in fees on top of everything else she already couldn't pay. And by the time Eric died in March of 22, according to prosecutors, Corey owed $7.5 million and was paying $80,000 every single month towards that debt. She had four separate payday lenders because God knows that's the best place to get money. A payday loan. Four. And she had committed to paying each of them, are you ready for this? $2,100 per day. There was also a $60,000 loan she'd taken out in December 21 that required repayment of $87,000 at 15% weekly interest. That one defaulted. The lender filed a lawsuit against K. Richens Realty, and there was the Iron Bridge loan, too, unpaid, extended once, extended again, with a new deadline of March 8th of 22, 4 days after Eric Richens died. This is the woman that Eric was married to. How would you react if your spouse was doing that sort of shit under your nose, bleeding your accounts dry, taking the money you worked so hard for in your own business, money that you have given to her, money that she stole as well, allegedly? And it's not like she's investing this in a business that's paying out dividends, that's hitting profits. Like, wow, good job, honey. You're really making this work. Can I give you more? No. She's taking like $1 and owing $10 to other people. And just digging the hole deeper, doing nothing, just going and making this worse and more chaotic and more horrible for herself and everyone involved. So for anyone who's like, oh, Eric was really tight with the purse strings. Did you ever consider maybe he didn't have a choice? And you know what? Judging by it, he wasn't tight with the purse strings. Anyone who's tight with the purse strings wouldn't have had $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 siphoned out from underneath them by their wife. That's not being tight with the purse strings. That's being ignorant with the purse strings. That's being generous with the purse strings. That's someone who in my opinion, based on this whole damn story, was sitting there trying to keep the peace with the purse strings. He had the funds to keep her at bay, to keep it at peace, because he cared about those kids. And he knew blowing up the world of his marriage with his wife was not the best of ideas, at least according to his calculation at that moment in time. Because if she's that reckless over here, God, if she's going to be having the kids 50-50, what other horrible decisions is she going to make while they're entrusted with her care? That's what Eric is thinking. Eric is hedging his bets because at the end of the day, it's about his kids, caring about his kids. It's not about the money his wife is wasting, although it's horrible and detrimental to everyone. I think Eric is hedging his bets. Eric is not an idiot. Eric knew his wife was a more than a hot mess. Unrestricted narcissistic chaos from hell is what Corey Richen seems to be. So Eric stuck around. And I want you to keep this in mind as we continue talking about this. And again, we cannot diagnose Corey, and we're not trying to. But let me say this. Narcissists, borderlines, one of the biggest things they fear, they hate, more than anything else, it's like frickin' kryptonite to them, is being held accountable and someone seeing behind the mask. And I can only imagine the utter, endless pit of shame that resided deep down in Corey Richens. Like, wait a second, they don't have shame. Oh, no, they do. I mean, they ultimately hate themselves. But there is that level, and they operate on it because it's so kryptonite-like. They can't stand being viewed as for what they actually are, which is usually a failure, usually someone who's made horrible decisions, impulsive choices that are never going to work out, never have worked out, and lead to the utter destruction of themselves and them around. And they don't ever want to be responsible for those choices. So when Eric is over here going, telling his friends and family, like, this is insane. She knows the wave is coming. It's about to crash in, and it's about to cap right over her head. So what does someone do who doesn't want to experience that wave of shame and disappointment and disgust from everyone around them that was brought on by their own poor choices? Well, get rid of the wave, of course. Like, wait, you can't get rid of waves? Like, well, kind of you can. I mean, the wave is a human. Others may try and figure out how to deal with the wave. Become accountable. Fix the problems. No, it's never truly someone's problem if, you drove me to do this, or I'm doing this because of this. Never, I'm doing this because I'm making my own autonomous choices, which is reality. No, it's someone else that made you do it. So if you can remove the wave that's about to crash on your head, you do it. We've seen it in other cases, Alec Murdaugh being an example. Family annihilation, basically. And it doesn't always have to be familiar. I would call it narcissistic annihilation. Destroy whoever is going to pull the mask down and expose you for who you are. More than anything else, I think that's what drove Corey Richens to kill her husband, in my opinion. If she did it. She didn't want the shame. She didn't want the exposure. It would happen no matter what. It's not like that's not going to happen. But folks like this will take every possible opportunity to slow that process down. Even if it means destroying so many things along the way. What's new with doing that? They've been destroying things forever. So to the rest of us, as shit's blowing up around them, that's just another Tuesday. Everybody else is like, what are you doing? You're destroyed. Like, hang on, I got to get another payday loan. That's my insight on where this case is. And by the way, I apologize for sniffling into the microphone. It's allergy season. The convergence of deadlines isn't something the prosecution invented. It is in the documents. And this is where the picture gets more complicated, because according to prosecutors, Corey was actively trying to hide it. Of course she was. Because they can't own up to their own BS. She submitted a document to Excel Financial Services claiming she had 147 employees. Her bank statement at the time showed balances of $1,500 to $2,000. This is not a payroll account for 147 people. Again, this is the shit they do. They just, if they say it aloud, everyone should just believe it, because, you know, she's Corey. You know, she's kind of cute. She's this young woman who's got this business going. She's entrepreneurial. I mean, on paper, it sounds lovely. It sounds great. Like, that's great. You go, girl. But goddamn, you're utterly clueless on what you're doing and saying aloud and how it doesn't match up to reality. Male, female, they all do this shit. It doesn't really matter. That's barely a payroll account for one. Carrington testified she found no evidence Corey ever profited. 1 million combined across all of her deals. And yet a document with her name on it was telling a lender she ran a company with nearly 150 employees. She ain't making money at all in this business, period. When Iron Bridge Financial flagged that her credit score was lower than expected and that there were delinquencies on her cards, Corey didn't acknowledge the problem. According to testimony, she told them everything had been paid off and then claimed that the credit issues were Eric's fault, citing it as one of the reasons they were heading for divorce. Of course it was, Corey. Of course it was, because it couldn't possibly be you. Carrington also testified that Corey's expense reporting to her tax preparer was inaccurate. Prosecutors argued the reason was straightforward. During this period, Corey needed her tax returns to show a profit so she could keep securing loans. A tax return showing the reality of her finances would have closed those doors. Even the ownership structure of her company appears to have been constructed for appearances. On paper, Corey's aunt Doreen owned 81% of Kay Richens Realty, but Carrington testified she couldn't locate any actual cash. She could locate no actual cash from Doreen in the business. What Doreen provided was her name and her credit, used to obtain loans and act as a guarantor. She was not, as far as Carrington could determine, a real funding source. So, I mean, this is an interesting tell. This is people around Corey that prop her up. They know she's a failure. They know she's an utter mess, and everything she touches just turns to shit. But your family, and people feel like they got to, you know, let's help Corey out. You know, I'm not going to give her money, but yeah, she can use. Never do that. At the end of the day, everyone's going to work in their own self-interest, and Corey certainly shows that that's pretty much all she does. And she's not good at that. And there's Chelsea Barney. In January of 2022, 2 months before Eric's death, Chelsea wired Corey $45,000. It was supposed to be a down payment on a home purchase. Text messages entered into evidence show the two women talking through the transaction in real time. Corey told Chelsea she needed $59,000 and only had $47,000 to work with. She told Chelsea the home would initially be in Corey's name, then transfer to Chelsea's within 2 weeks. When the wire hit Corey's account, the balance was already negative. Almost half of that $45,000 went immediately to Corey's personal joint checking account. And from there, according to Carrington, the money was transferred to a payday lender. Not the property, a payday lender. She's robbing Peter to pay Paul. But it's more like she's executing Peter, hanging him from a tree, finding another guy named Jack down the road, killing him, stealing all of his money, burning his house down, lighting a bank on fire, taking more money, having another campfire over here, burning cash. And then when people are like, what are you doing? You got like fires everywhere. You're literally setting a campfire with cash. It's kind of Eric. I mean, what the hell? In text, Corey wrote, I'm kind of nervous. Ha. Chelsea replied, I'm so excited, but I'm scared as hell. You should be. One of them has a good reason to be. Now go back to the Midway Mansion, because with all of that context in place, that closing document on March 5th reads very differently. Corey had already texted someone about the property before purchasing it. The message was introduced as evidence. Quote, it's definitely out of my league, but the margins are so insane that I had to pick it up and then figure it out. Ha ha, help! Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Ha 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 ha. She borrowed $3.2 million to buy a $2.9 million house with no renovation funds, no clear exit strategy, and a net worth that Carrington calculated after the closing was negative, $1.6 million. $8 million in liabilities, roughly $6.4 in assets, and even if she had liquidated everything she owed the day she walked out of that closing, it still wouldn't have been enough to get back to zero. And keep in mind, this mansion she bought, it was a shell of a home. It's one of those where, okay, well, we got like the shell up, the structure. It's starting to resemble one. You're going to need to put, I don't know. I mean, just I'm looking at it. I've done a few home renos in my life. I'm guessing a home that size, the way it looked, you're looking at least another million, at least, to put into that thing. Her plan, her liquidity, her ability to secure more money to do that, zero. Actually, in the negative. If Corey's about to go ask people for more money, they're asking her for money back. Carrington put it plainly on the stand. Corey Richens was in financial distress and her financial enterprise was collapsing. And but for a significant infusion of cash and capital, it would have continued to collapse. It was imploding. And Eric Richens, according to prosecutors, had $2.2 million in life insurance policies. Well, tough frickin' da. All you got to do is kill your husband, right? I mean, that's it. What a good deal. You kill him and you get a check. Why didn't anybody suggest this sooner, right, Corey? Corey listed Midway Mansion for sale on March 12th of 2022. 7 days after she bought it, no offers held. The property eventually entered foreclosure, because of course it did, because she didn't do anything in 7 days. You can't. The debt came due in September of 2022 and went unpaid at a 2% default fee, and roughly $50,000 was added, with another 2% accruing every month after that. The defense pushed back on all of it. Attorney Kathy Nestor challenged Carrington directly during cross-examination, asking why banks would allow someone this deep in debt to keep borrowing. Carrington's answer was that Eric's accounts were active and making money, which made the overall financial picture look more viable to lenders than it actually was. Nestor pointed out that a HELOC, a $250,000 home equity line of credit that was over its limit at the time of Eric's death, was an account Eric had full access to and could have checked at any time. Her argument, Eric was not a passive bystander to these finances. He was on the accounts. He could have looked. Sure, he could have. Maybe he did. And he also weighed his options. Crazy bitch with the kids. Mean financial torture. The kids are going to come above the finances. Why? Because Eric puts his children before money. What a concept. Nestor went further, arguing that the entire financial narrative proved nothing about whether Corey killed her husband, that drawing the line between debt and murder was speculation, not evidence, and had zero bearing on the actual charge. I beg to differ. Those arguments are real, and the jury will weigh them. The defense hasn't put on its case yet, and Corey Richin is entitled to every reasonable doubt this evidence leaves open. But here's what cross-examination couldn't change. According to Carrington, Corey received approximately $1.35 million from Eric's life insurance policies after his death. She spent all of it within 3 months. Less than half went to paying down the debt that Carrington described as imploding. And by September of 22, 6 months after Eric died, Corey had $800 left in her account. A man is dead. Three children are without their father. Corey Richin says she had nothing to do with it, but just the other day, prosecutors put a forensic accountant on the stand to show the jury the precise financial value that Eric Richin's life, and according to prosecutors, his death, ultimately produced. In September of 22, that number was $800. The trial continues. What do you think? What do you think? This goes so far beyond just, oh, you're spending a little bit too much at the mall. We don't really have the money to, this is like wiping out all finances, because that's really what she did. She had more debt, and between the two of them had more debt than they actually had assets. He had a successful company going. She was actively trying to, it seems, take on more debt as her business continued to fail, and ultimately securing it with the success of her husband, a success that was not hers. And I'm telling you, from experience, we go back to these personality types. They don't like the success of others. They feel intimidated by it. They feel jealous of it. Makes them feel inadequate because they have to be number one, even though they're not, and never have been, and never will be, and don't realize you kind of got to work to get there. It's not just handed to you. But they want what others have. It's always putting on the mask. It's always putting on the aura of something that they are not. And when it comes time for exposure, when all of the shit walls that they put up to try and shield the world from seeing exactly what they are, when they see that threat coming in, when she saw Eric finally putting up his hand saying, no more, that exposure was real. That exposure was imminent. And that exposure would have completely destroyed anything that was left of her. And she would have had to admit her faults, come clean, and start over. Still a better alternative than killing the father of your children that's been funding your madness. Again, the prism through which these folks look through makes this all make sense to them. It's a cognitive distortion. How do they do it? Study borderlines and narcissists, and Corey Richin's will make all the sense in the world to you. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case. And again, we're not diagnosing her. We can't. Just saying she fits a pattern, without a doubt. In my opinion, press subscribe wherever you get podcasts and on Substack. The links are in the descriptions. And be sure to press subscribe wherever Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're downloading audio so you can take us with you on the go, and on YouTube as well. Looking forward to continuing our conversation there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Corey Richens' defense team, Kathy Nestor, Wendy Lewis, and Alex Ramos, has been surgical in attacking the prosecution's case. They've exposed contradictions in witness testimony, resurfaced questions about the investigation's integrity, and highlighted critical forensic tests that were never performed. But the prosecution still has witnesses to call, and the defense hasn't even begun their own case. I'm wondering if they stole one of the things that we brought up on the show here the other week, hair follicle testing, because that was brought up as an interesting point the other day. And I think the other week when we were talking about it, why didn't anyone do hair follicle testing? Because that could really show us a track record here, because yeah. It's like rings on a tree. It would show us if he had been an active user of fentanyl for a period of time, or if this was an extreme one-off. The testing wasn't done. They made a big point of that.
I felt like Ramos was watching us.
I think there's been so many damn cases where we bring it up here and the next day it's going on out there.
So I
do wonder about that. But it's a good point that was made, because it really could answer a lot of questions. Yeah. And for one side, it's not going to be good. We don't know which side, though, because we don't know what that test is going to show. And since it was never done, it was never ordered, along with a whole bunch of other tests that were never ordered. It's out in the ether, and the defense is using that as saying, see, you didn't test this. If you're so, you know, concerned that this is, you know, that this was something that she did, why didn't we do this test? How damaging do you think that was, or how helpful do you think that was to either side?
Well, I think that that posing the question was very helpful for the defense, because mm-hmm. I think that's going to sit with the jurors, because I think if the point of this thing, like any trials, to get to the truth, not mm-hmm. to secure a conviction, right? We're trying to get to the truth in these cases. And that would have been a way for them to potentially achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. Because it's not as if the state of Utah did not know what their defense was going to be.
Yeah.
This thing was highly litigated for 2.5-3 years. And I'm talking mm-hmm. highly litigated.
Yeah.
And it was Sky Lazaro prior to Nestor and Lewis. There was a lot of pretrial motions that were filed in this thing. So there was no secret that the defense was going to be saying that, look, Eric had a drug problem, you know, and it stems from his addiction to pain pills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it continued. And we know that there's a witness out there that's going to testify that he was a user in high school, you know, that he popped pills back then. And, you know, whether or not the jury's going to give that any weight, who knows? But
yeah.
The point being is that they knew it. The state knew that this was a potential avenue for the defense to take. And for them to say, well, you know, we've got this ability to be able to test the follicles to see whether or not that holds any water, I think casts a little more shade on the state that they were afraid of getting the answer, because yeah. he could turn around and bite him in the ass. Mm-hmm. Because had it come back, well, like, yeah, I mean, it shows there was fentanyl in his system, like even beyond February when they're claiming that she tried to poison him with the sandwich, yeah. you know, but it's like, you know, if it goes back, because I don't know. And Ramos was getting into it a little bit in terms of getting into the weeds, in terms of how far back it can go. He threw out 3 months. I had heard that it can go back a little further.
I did some research on it the other day and dug pretty deep. You could exhume him today. You could probably get fairly accurate testing that would show us definitively whether he was an active user through the course of that strand growing, basically.
Now, the interesting legal question about that is, say she gets convicted, say the direct appeal fails, say they go into post-conviction act world, and that's where you can bring in newly discovered evidence.
Boom.
Now, I don't know that they would be able to argue, the defense, that is newly discovered, because they had access at the time where, theoretically, you know, I mean, Nestor and look, these two attorneys have been appointed. She was found to be indigent after Lazaro left. And, you know, but you've got this situation where Nestor, if they have to go hat in hand to the court and say the county's got to pay for this testing, did they even make an attempt to do that? You know, well, so like that concept where in terms of being able to go in, newly discovered evidence is always viewed through that lens by the courts, whether or not it's actually newly discovered.
Would that be based on who's going to pay for it, though? Or like, let's say her family just says, we want to go do this testing. We'll pay for it. Then here's the results, everybody. That's new evidence. We didn't have this information before. Could we have gotten it? Sure. But the state didn't have to pay for it.
Well, that's the legal question, though.
That would be the legal. I don't know what that would be.
Yeah, because I mean, like you. Go ahead, Robin.
No, I was just thinking, too. I mean, I don't like giving, you know, any bad guys, and she's not a bad person yet, you know, the intelligence to do something so premeditated. But it's interesting because if we entertain the thought experiment that he actually had a drug habit ahead of time and that this was, you know, a mistake on his part, he overdosed by mistake, and if she's any part of this, you know, it's actually trying to hide in plain sight by just exasperating mm-hmm. something he's part of. But at the same time, though, her demeanor and her behavior of being unwitting to any of those problems is actually pretty congruent with if he did have a drug problem, she was not aware of it. But it would make sense if she was. But here's the counter to this again, getting all these different little data points to analyze this on is, if she thought that actually was a defense, why wouldn't she press for the hair follicles being tested?
Right.
I mean, I would. I mean, seriously. I mean, so here you are. You're her, and you mm-hmm. do a great job of being her, her family in those shoes from the defense angles. And if you think this is a possibility to exonerate you or explain away what happened, why wouldn't you make a full court press, even to the press, saying to do this?
100%.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
It's that thing where, you know, that you'll see sometimes in cases where neither side necessarily wants to know the answer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like we had it in Richard Allen where there was some DNA that was an unknown male profile and neither side did anything with it. And it was blowing my mind because I was saying the same thing. I'm like, if I'm Allen, if I didn't do it, I'm screaming at my attorneys, why aren't you testing that unknown male profile? Because I guarantee you it ain't mine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, this is a little more far afield than that. But I mean, it's a legitimate question.
Just think of all the blind spots that would answer by just testing the hair follicle. And I'll tell you, I'm with you. You know, Dr. Christensen did an amazing job.
Great job.
And here's one, you know, it's actually, you know, on the behavior side of things, here's why I thought he did an amazing job. Besides the facts, the details, his presentation, when you listened to that call, you heard his level of care and professionalism when he said, it's no problem at all. Call me anytime. That was someone who's about his business, very pragmatic, very, very, very objective with delivering bad news. And I mean, he was so well presented, both himself and the content. I thought he did a decent job of talking about this with his limited resources and limited things he did have, you know, between what was in his stomach, what's not in his stomach, and then the mix of the other compound in there and how this fell right in between, whether it was an addict or not an addict, a one time off. It really is too bad they didn't do that hair follicle. Wish they should.
I know. And I mean, it was one of those things. I just thought he was. And I said it during our live, I'm like, for Corey Rishens to be able to call the office of the medical examiner, and we're talking about the medical examiner in Utah, and get him on the phone was amazing to me.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can't believe she got him on the phone.
I know.
Well, what about just the modality of doing that? That's an interesting thing to do. Are you calling the medical? I mean, just thinking in normal, I know it is normal, but if you are concerned that, let's just put it in the perspective of where she might have been sitting at that moment in time. If you're concerned that someone may be looking at you for suspected murder of your husband, are you going to be raising your hand in any way, shape, or form to ask questions and get on the radar of anything?
Yeah.
Would you?
I am. Because remember, this is 8 months in the probate mm-hmm. battle, Tony. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend you dig into some of those pleadings, man.
Okay.
The family and Corey were at war.
Okay, so that's why she was doing that. Okay, that's what I'm trying to understand. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just trying to go, why is she doing it? Like, what's the modality? Why is she making this phone call? Because to me, it's like, if you're trying to stay off the radar or something, I don't know that I'd be making the phone call. I don't know that I'd be raising my hand if I did it. I'm saying if I did it. I'm saying that's like for in the Corey camp of that actually points to more innocence than it does guilt. I
agree, you know, but frankly, either way.
Yeah.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and logically that makes sense that if she did do it, you'd think that you wouldn't touch that with a 1,000,000-foot pole. You could obviously make the other argument that, well, I'm going to do it, so it makes me look like I'm just curious what's going on, because I know the family thinks that I killed him.
I might not also write a children's book about it either if I don't want attention at me. And so clearly
she's doing research for the book. Yeah. She wants to be accurate.
Clearly having attention at her wasn't a problem. She was all good with that, no matter how you splice it. And if we look at it this way or that way, or this personality or that type of personality, you know, it can go down different paths. Go ahead, Robin.
I did look up, typical calls that are made to medical examiners, the typical questions that are asked. And she was really in the ballpark, and that goes to what you both your points earlier on. Her ability, whether she did or not, to compartmentalize is really, really strong, and everything she's doing is pretty congruent with what you'd expect her to do. But it's so easy to have her confirmation bias one side or the other. But it was within the norm.
Let's talk about the drugs that were procured by Corey from person to person to person to person. It's not really up for debate here that she procured drugs. That I think is well established. The evidence is there. The texts are there. The chain is there. It's more so a question of what did she procure? What did she think she was getting? And if you take the name of the drug out of this whole equation, which seems to be the big thing everyone's arguing in court, is the semantics of, well, is it fentanyl or not? Because he died of fentanyl. Well, guess what? In all of the communications, nobody's talking about fentanyl, but it also they're talking about shit they don't know what they're talking about either. You have Corey asking for propofol, basically, but she just describes it as the Michael Jackson stuff. She doesn't ask for it by name. She just wants the something even stronger, as she puts it. At the end of the day, does it matter what they all called it? Because I don't think any of them were either in the right mindset to know what the hell they were dealing with or getting. They were street drug deal. It was from a street drug dealer who also admitted on the stand that, guess what? Fentanyl's laced into a lot of this shit too. I didn't specifically sell fentanyl. I didn't think I was selling fentanyl, but it turns out a lot of the stuff over here called Oxy is actually fentanyl. So that's in the mix. Does it matter? Does it matter that Corey didn't know it was fentanyl? Does it matter that the dealer didn't know it was fentanyl? But at the end of the day, it looks like somebody mixed some fentanyl into the Oxy and then it ended up in his system. Does the semantics matter other than trying to confuse a jury, which I get, that's the strategy here. But at the end of the day, she wanted the stronger stuff. She got stronger stuff. Does it matter what it truly is or if she knew what it truly was?
Yes, of course.
How? Okay.
It's aggravated murder requires, it's a very specific statute. And, you know, you and I talk about this all the time. The state has to prove each and every element of that statute. And if you pull that statute up, it has to be intentionally or knowingly procuring. And they're going under the poison statute is what I call it. In terms of she has to know, just getting some shit off the streets ain't it.
Well, but she's asking for it as the Michael Jackson stuff.
Bullshit. The propofol, like people keep saying that it was a cocktail. It wasn't just that. It was benzos, dude. It wasn't.
No, I'm asking because she asked for the Michael Jackson. She wants the Michael Jackson stuff is what she said. Allegedly.
If you believe Carmen.
Okay, so that's the allegation she asked for, basically. When someone is asking for the Michael Jackson stuff, it's not they're going to ask for stuff that's going to make them go open up an amusement park in their backyard. It's shit that's going to kill them.
That's not what killed him. It was a cocktail of benzos and
but she asked for stronger stuff for that purpose. So does it, again, it's does it matter if she even knows what the hell it is? She's asking for something that's going to kill her husband, basically.
I don't construe it that way.
How do you not?
Because Propofol is not what killed him. It was a
no, it's not.
But it's like saying, like, I want the Matthew Perry drug.
But you gotta, somebody's like, I'll give you shit that kills you. And whatever it is,
ketamine's
it is.
It's not going to kill you. Like, fentanyl is a fucking poison, man.
It is, but she didn't know what she was talking about. She was asking for something to kill her husband with.
Let's go to intent. What's the intent of her purpose?
That's the purpose. Yeah.
That is what the state has to prove.
Right.
And that's why it has to be. Because look, in 2022, we all were hearing about everybody. If you were paying any attention at all to what was going on in the world, everyone was dying from this fentanyl that was being like introduced into the black market drug market. Mm-hmm. And like, so in my world, the intent, which has to be intentional or knowing, it can't be, I just need some shit. I want enough Roxy 30s that I'm going to crush 70 of them up. But
that's
into
not what
shit.
She said. She asked for the Michael Jackson.
That's not what, like, you're taking what Carmen said, who I did not find to be a credible witness, as gospel. I mean, if you're going to give that the weight, then give it the weight. But to me, the Michael Jackson drug, I had to Google it. I had to Google and see what the.
And I know she didn't get propofol. I know she. And you couldn't get propofol. Nobody's like dealing propofol on the street.
I go back to the intent, Bob.
Yeah.
So what I'm curious about on the defense side is, so I think everyone's saying that there was a purchase of drugs, correct?
Yeah.
That,
all right. 100%, right.
So now defense has to. What do you think defense is going to do to show her the intent she had in the purchase? That's what I'm.
They don't have to do anything. You know that, Robin. What is the state going to do to prove that was her intent? Because what the defense is going to argue is that he had an addiction problem and that he was the one asking her to procure. He had an addiction to pain pills.
But she didn't say that, though. I mean, so in order for the defense to use that she procured it for him, she'd have to say, I procured it for him because he's got an addiction problem. Is that what you think she's going to say?
Theoretically, if she takes a stand. Like, I mean, the problem for her is the walk the dog letter.
Right.
So many landmines for her to take the stand.
Right.
It's, you know, like,
and that's why I thought this is, that's why, you know, and I get Tony's point on this as well. Is like, it doesn't matter what they bought. She had an intent to get this. And so if the intent wasn't murder or the intent wasn't to give it to him without his wittiness, what was the intent?
But that's the state's burden to prove entirely.
Yeah. But still the jury's still going to hear it.
But yeah, they're going to hear it, but the state has to prove that her specific intent. So aggravated felony or aggravated murder is a specific intent.
Right, right. I understand.
Can't be, you know, well, maybe like if he has too much, he died. It had to be, I'm procuring a poison, which I know will kill him. And then so I used it to kill him.
So again, my question is this, how do you, because again, this is not my area when dealing in the courtroom, obviously, you know, so then how do you present that and the instructions you give to the jury to not then make that leap that, you know, so she bought it. We definitely confirm she bought the drugs and these are illegal drugs or whatever they are. And you can't come to any conclusion because the prosecution didn't do it right, that she bought them to give to her husband. I mean, how do you, what kind of instructions came to do a jury to not make that leap on their own?
I mean, in terms of the instructions, they're going to get whatever instructions they use in Utah. You know, they're pattern jury instructions that they use. So they'll use the instruction that they give to every jury in every homicide case. So whatever that is, and I haven't pulled it up yet on our feed, like we do that close towards the end of trial, but whatever it's going to be is it's going to say that they have to prove each and every element. They're going to say that she had to knowingly or intentionally, and it's either or, had to procure something that she knew was going to kill her husband and that was her intent. Kill her husband. The problem for the state here is the investigation was so shitty.
Right.
The common theme that we see through case after case after case after case, because, you know, you have the first cop who walks in and she tells the story about the Moscow mule, yet this cop doesn't see fit to say, all right, I'm going to go look in the sink to see if the cups are there. I'm going to look at the bedstead. Because, like, Robin, right. I have to think, as a former FBI guy, you get a guy who's saying, you get anybody who's saying that to you in their initial interview, the first things they're saying to you, you're like, okay, well,
take that.
Let's start looking around for these cups.
Right.
You know, where are those cups? Like, I'm not accusing you of anything, but what exactly did you serve them the drink in? Oh, well, you know, the copper mugs that you serve Moscow mules in. Mm-hmm. And where are those? Oh, those are in the sink. I'm gonna go ahead and grab those. Put my gloves on, drop them into an evidence bag, and we're gonna test those to see if we can find any trace of ethanol or fentanyl, rather. And you know, because it was interesting in terms of his blood when they did the testing on the blood, they found no alcohol in the blood.
Right.
They found ethanol in the body, but as Christensen said, the body produces ethanol, and it produces it from all kinds of things.
Yep.
So that's not indicative of the fact that he had the alcohol in his body. So it doesn't corroborate what the state's theory is that she dosed the fentanyl,
right,
or dosed the drink. I mean, so it's challenging for the state, man. It really is, because of the gaping holes in the investigation on the front end. It goes to what you were saying earlier, Robin, which is, this is going to be death by 1,000 paper cuts for them.
Yeah.
It's going to create this arc where either the jury's going to buy the narrative what the state has created, because the state wasn't there, just like the defense was there. Nobody really knows what happened. Like, all that we can do as attorneys on both sides is take the evidence and craft a theory based on what we believe might have happened. And we'd go and try to sell that to the jury. And whichever side sells it more authentically to the jury, to where the jury's like, I just can't overlook that fact. And yes, it's all circumstantial, but it all makes sense to me. And typically, the way that it works in this country, that defendant in that chair gets convicted.
I got one follow-up to this, Tony. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Taking time. So Bob, so you know how to connect with the defense a lot. You know, you're working with these families. I mean, so put on your theory hat. What do you think, you know, might have been going through her mind to purchase those drugs?
Well, if I'm Corey, and it goes back to that question, how do I get it in? Right. If I'm Corey, I'm saying Eric had a drug problem and Eric had asked me to procure them. And you can't even show that I went to the house to pick them up, that it was Eric. He asked me to call Carmen, because I knew from my relationship with her over the years that she had an addiction problem. And, you know, I knew that she had access to a dealer because that's how she was getting her drugs. And so I hit her up at the behest of my husband because he wanted these pills. The other part of it where, you know, I don't know if the defense is going to take the walk the dog strategy, wherein they're going to say that he was procuring these drugs through some cartel / rancher at some place down in Mexico that he went to. I have no idea. I mean, to me, the safer argument that I'm trying to make, if I'm the defense, is that Eric had a pill problem, which then still goes back
to
the issue of why didn't we test the hair follicle?
Yeah.
Because it either proves or disproves that theory immediately. It's a fascinating case, man.
Bob, could they admit anything like that at this point in the trial? If somebody said, let's go get a fucking hair.
I think if neither side were to object to it, potentially, because it's so late in the game.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's so late in the game, and I don't know how long that testing takes. And
yeah,
like, look, we saw it in, I you know how I always go back to Richard Allen, but we had the hair that was wrapped around Abby's finger. There was a female hair, which they didn't fucking test for 7 years.
Let me get me going on Richard Allen, man. You and me, all of us are on the same sheet. That was
they didn't get the results until trial had started.
Yeah. They would tell us so much, and maybe that's just the card that Corey's going to keep in her back pocket if she gets convicted, and maybe it can be an appellate issue. Maybe, who knows?
We'll see.
But it won't
be on direct appeal. It'll have to be post conviction. You're stuck to the record. You know, only the things that happen at trial and pretrial for your direct appeal. When she loses that, which I'm sure she would. Ultimately, that's where you get into that post-conviction. That's where you go after ineffective assistance of counsel claims, as well as, you know, newly discovered evidence. And then your battle is it newly discovered? You had access to that evidence at the time going into trial. Why didn't you test it?
Yeah.
You know, because that's what I'm saying.
Sure.
The defense had the ability to go to the judge and say, "Judge, I'm on bended knee here. My client's indigent. Mm-hmm. We want to get this hair tested because we feel that it's potentially exculpatory to our client." Yeah. And the judge is probably going to say, "All right, I'm going to give you some county funds. Have at it." So see how it plays out.
Would be very interesting. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and our Substack. Love to get you weighing in on the Corey Richens trial.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.